here and welcome to the Pack Heavy podcast. Now, this podcast is for anyone who works in the hospitality and food manufacturing industries who use flexible packaging to get their products to market. Featuring interviews with guests who have traveled the path that you're on so that you can learn from their successes and failures and engage in the mindset required to go all in on your vision. I call this mindset the Pack Heavy mentality, and it's primarily driven by deliberate action and extreme organization. You gather market intelligence, put a strong plan in place, organize the appropriate resources, and then confidently test your hypothesis against reality. So if you're ready to pack heavy on your vision, you're in the right place, and I'm excited to have you here. Good morning, and welcome to episode 24 of the Pack Heavy podcast. Today, I'm excited to be having a good chat with Sarah Davies from More Granola. Based in Toronto, Ontario, and founded by Sarah 11 months ago, More Granola is a hot-off-the-press CBG startup venture that has seen some impressive early growth. With four plant-based, gluten-free, and all-natural flavors to choose from, More Granola can be found both online and in over 30 retailers across Ontario. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited to be here.
Yeah, no, you're welcome. I love having conversations with founders of startup businesses just like yourself, especially in these early days. Like, you're not even about to hit the 12-month mark. It can't be too far away.
I know, it's not too far away. It's crazy. I've been full-time since January 2021.
Yeah.
And it's just a total dream come true. Being able to do what I love every day is great.
Yeah. And I see on LinkedIn that you've come from the banking background. So I would love to, during the conversation, have a bit of a chat about what it was that sort of enabled you to muster up the courage to be able to leap into your business full-time, because I'm sure that would have taken a little bit of time to sort of work your way into. But before that, where are you from? Where did you grow up?
I'm from Toronto. I grew up in the east end of the city, mm-hmm. on the Danforth, actually.
Yep, I know it.
And I've lived here all of my life. I've spent a couple years studying abroad. Mm. So first I did a year in the UK, and then most recently I did almost a year in Spain.
Yeah, I saw that. That's where you did your MBA.
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome. And so when you were studying overseas, tell me about the value that you found in completing your MBA. Was it everything that you thought it would be or more, or where did you land in the end?
So I started my MBA in September 2019. Mm. And it was more than I expected, for sure. It was just such an overwhelming experience, but in the best way possible. Like, you just have so many options all the time to participate in things, learn new things, engage with different people. My program was super multicultural. We had 64 different nationalities in my class alone. So yeah, literally people from all over the world, which was great. But in the middle of the program is when the pandemic actually hit. So I was about halfway through March 2020 when COVID descended upon us.
Yeah, and, changed the world, didn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So I ended up completing that program remotely.
Mm, so you got on a plane and came home as soon as you could before the borders closed?
Exactly.
Yeah,
I was actually in the air when they announced that it was a global pandemic, which was crazy. I got off the plane and had all of these notifications telling me about, like, you know, it's now been declared by the WHO a pandemic, and it was just so surreal.
Oh, I can only imagine. Like, yeah, it was pretty crazy on our end as well here locally. But I know you guys have been hit really, really hard in Ontario, and there's been, you know, extended shutdown periods and, you know, schooling from home. Tell us a little bit about how it's impacted you, apart from having to fly back home during the middle of your MBA and finishing schooling online. But tell us a little bit about, you know, the other impacts that you've been encountered or that you've encountered.
Yeah, you know, it was a really great opportunity, because as soon as I flew home, pretty much, we did transition to remote learning, and that took a little bit off of my plate while completing my program. And right away I started planning this business, and it was something that brought me a lot of hope and had me looking positively into the future instead of focusing on all of the scary things that we were hearing in the news. So it was a bit of a blessing to start working on it right away. And then I was able to soft launch right after I graduated. So August 2020, launched the business. And it's been interesting, because there's some things that are different in a good way, and some things, some challenges that the situation presents. So for example, the focus on shopping local has been really, really amazing to see, and the support from my community has been so great. But then on the flip side, you know, I think everybody's feeling a little bit of isolation, and,
yeah,
you know, starting a business is such an intense experience, and it's even more isolating than it normally would be because of the circumstances.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't doubt it for a second. So were you mulling over the idea of this business during your MBA, and you sort of wrote a business plan throughout that course, or was it something that you decided to take on post MBA?
So I've actually been dreaming of starting this business since I was like in my early teens.
Really?
I've always loved granola, and I've never loved the options on the grocery store shelves. I felt like it's such a crowded category. There were so many options, but there wasn't one that really checked all of those boxes for me. So I always made my own, and I've always had requests from friends all over the world to bring granola every time I visit, which I found kind of funny. So it's always been something I wanted to do. I was a little scared to enter into it because I didn't know what that looked like. I didn't know what starting a business looked like. And, you know, every time I would say to somebody, oh, I'm like, I love granola, I'd love to do something in granola one day, like, I just didn't know what that could potentially look like. Would it be starting a restaurant? Would it be launching a brand? And it wasn't really until I met my current partner that I think I had the confidence to say, yeah, I'm gonna launch a granola brand one day. And that day is gonna be very, very soon. So I went into the program knowing that I wanted to do this after it.
Right.
And I set that intention out at the very, very beginning of the course.
Yep.
And told all my peers. So it was really great because people were constantly giving me ideas and saying, oh yeah, you're looking to do this, right? Like, let's collaborate. And I come from this background, I can help you in this way. It was really, really helpful to set out that intention.
That's great. So, I mean, just jumping on your website and, you know, getting stuck into that so that I could familiarize myself with, you know, the brand and where I perceive that you're at, it looks like you're really established. So you've put a lot of time and energy into your website, it seems, and the photography especially is beautiful.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, the website has had quite a few iterations. It's a bit of an evolving thing, but it's great. I work with a very talented photographer who's done a lot of the product photography, and very talented designer who's really helped build the brand out.
Yeah, that's cool. So back before you even hit the ground running and started producing product, tell me a little bit about the idea and what you had in mind and what your vision was for the business and how it's adjusted over time to where it is today.
Mm-hmm. So I mentioned that, you know, I've always wanted to start a granola brand. I always particularly liked granola chunks. So I used to pick out granola chunks and snack on them, but, you know, they're so rare in a typical box of granola. So you'd stand there like shaking the box and waiting for one to appear and picking it out. So I always made my granola really, really chunky. And that was something that I wanted to create when I launched this brand. But I had assumed that when the bags of granola were going to be in transport, that they would break up a little bit. So I made them a little bit chunkier than I had ever made before.
Yeah.
Thinking that they would break, of course, and they didn't. So I would get these images back from consumers of pulling out this giant granola piece that's like almost like a cookie.
Yeah.
And just their awe and excitement at that.
Cool.
And the flexibility that it gave them.
Yep.
Was something that really sparked my interest. And I was like, oh, like, this isn't what I intended to do, but it's actually really cool because it gives people this flexibility to either eat it just with a cup of coffee by itself.
Yeah.
And have it as a bit of an on-the-go snack, or break it up and eat it in so many different ways, like breakfast bowls, on top of ice cream, anything. So it was something that surprised me, and I really pivoted very quickly to focusing on that and
on the
knowing
chunks.
On the chunks, knowing that that was going to be what set me apart from all the other granola on the market. So
yeah,
a little bit of a cross between a granola cereal and a granola bar.
Yeah. That's really cool to find your unique value proposition so early on, because it takes a lot of people. Well, in my experience of interviewing people on this podcast, it takes some time to sort of consolidate and really crystallize what it is that separates you from your consumer. And a lot of people focus on brand, which is awesome, and the persona of the brand and the way that they go to market to sort of separate themselves. But to actually have a product that you know, like you just suggested, in a crowded market, a way to differentiate yourself in the actual product itself is really unique and cool that you're getting that feedback.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. It was a bit surprising, but it was also really like lucky the way that it happened. And to your point, there's so many different ways that you can differentiate yourself, like on ingredients, on branding, and it can get a little bit confusing. I think, you know, you're trying to set yourself apart on different facets. So if you have too many different value propositions, I think it can be a bit noisy and confusing for consumers.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. Really,
yeah.
When you were going to market or you were just starting out, did you know who your early adopter was and who you were specifically targeting?
I didn't. I assumed that my early adopter would be someone similar to me. Someone that just loves food, tries to eat healthy. And my early adopter, I assumed would be a typical granola eater. And I think that my target market has evolved over time to people that might not typically eat granola, because that's where I find the biggest excitement comes from, is those people who want to eat healthy, but don't like traditional granola. They find it bland or boring and not very exciting. And this is something that they don't have to eat with a spoon.
That's
out
cool.
Of a bowl.
Yeah. So how are you finding these people? How are you getting out in front of them?
So it's been a lot of trial and error. I initially launched very softly August 2020, just to family and friends. I had a little bit of word of mouth early on and a little bit of exposure via social media. So it's been great to connect with people over Instagram and find consumers that way. From there, it's really just been getting in stores and doing a couple of virtual sampling initiatives that have helped people discover me and try me out. And I find that's really, really helpful once people get a taste.
Yeah. Sampling is just so critical in this world, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a reason definitely. That Costco does it every weekend.
Used to.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, I didn't think of that. I haven't been in a Costco for a while. Cool. So, yeah, tell me a little bit about your production. How do you go about producing the product? Is it a commissary kitchen or if you got your own space?
I actually rent space in a local bakery right now.
Oh, great.
So just in their off hours, and it was a partnership that I sought out. Right when I was starting up, I knew I needed commercial kitchen space, and somebody else in the industry actually recommended canvassing my local area and seeing if there were any businesses that wanted some additional, an additional
revenue stream
for their kitchen.
Yeah. I can imagine everybody would be screaming out for something like that right now. So that's a really good call.
Yeah. It's worked out really well. It's been a great partnership.
Yeah. Cool. So you're doing everything by hand and then packaging it up by hand as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm at that stage where I'm a little too small for co-packing and a little probably too big for doing it by myself, but
that's where we are. Yeah, cool. So obviously being the founder, are you doing absolutely everything yourself right now? Or have you managed to sort of offload some of the things that you've found are not necessarily your weaknesses, but areas that you could outsource easily?
Mm-hmm. I'm doing most things myself. There's a couple of things that I outsource, like I mentioned I work with a photographer, designer, some delivery as well. So things like there are a lot of things that are quite easy to outsource, but most is kept in-house or just me, basically.
Yeah. How do you think you'll know when it is time to sort of approach a co-packer and scale your business more?
Yeah, I have approached co-packers.
Okay.
So I'm in talks with a couple of them.
Yep.
And trying to make that decision and navigate setting up that value chain right now. So with the co-packer, then ideally comes a fulfillment center and a distributor as well. So setting up all of that in one swoop is my goal.
Yeah. Awesome. Have you considered the margin that everybody's going to, or the snip of the margin that you've got in your product that everybody's going to take along the way?
Yeah, definitely. I was really lucky early on. Another producer looked at my pricing at the beginning and just told me flat out, you do not have enough room in here for the various margins you need to consider and you need to up your price. And luckily I did that early on and built in the margins quite early. You know, when you start out, you're buying things in small quantities, you're doing things yourself. So your labor cost is very high. Your rent for your kitchen's probably high.
Yeah.
You're obviously going to have economies of scale as you grow and those things change. So there's room there where my margin will go down a little bit and will create a little bit of room. And I priced my product with those margins in mind for sure.
Yeah. Awesome. I know that's such a smart way to do it. And I've heard it from a few people that I've had on the podcast, whether it's Andrea Grant Gray, with Good to Grow, or Kenny Vannucci, who's got his own consulting business as well. And you're absolutely right. Not many people do actually consider it in the early days. And I think it's an awareness thing. When you were considering, you know, your go-to-market strategy and where you would sit in terms of pricing, how did you go about formulating the price?
I looked at a lot of my competitors in the category and ingredient lists, primarily sizing ingredient lists, and went from there. I had an idea in mind of what I wanted to price it at, just from the consumer standpoint. But then, as I said, when another producer pointed out, you know, this is just too low. You can't produce a product that's this high quality and has these ingredients and has this packaging and sell it for this. You're going to fail.
Price yourself out of the business. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Eve from Eve's Crackers said exactly the same thing. And I mean, her product, because it is a premium product and it's positioned as a premium product, demands that price point. She said she had quite a bit of fear going out. Well, not fear, but like a little bit of trepidation going out there priced a little bit higher than everybody else. But it's turned out that that extra margin has really helped grow the business in terms of the revenue generated from it.
Yeah, definitely. Because sometimes, you know, it feels nerve-wracking to present that price to family and friends and say, oh, it's $12 for a bag of granola. Like, what? When you can get a box for $5, even less sometimes. It's definitely premium priced. But luckily, I think from the time that Eve started, there are a lot more products out there that are priced like that. And I think consumers are starting to see the value of, hey, you know what? It is this price point, but I can read the ingredients. I can understand the ingredients.
Yeah.
There's transparency into the company and their production practices. There's so much value that's in all of that, and it's starting to translate for sure.
Yeah, and it's supporting somebody local in the area as well, which is really cool. And I think, you know, you mentioned it before, due to COVID, everybody's really sort of focused on, you know, decreasing the size of their, you know, not only where they're accessing their food from, but where they're shopping from as well. I think a lot of people are sticking to sort of local little grocery stores and supermarkets and online retailers as well. It's awesome.
Yeah. It's been really nice.
Yeah. I noticed you'd had a couple of iterations, or I saw at least one iteration on your packaging as well. So what was your approach there? Did you start with a stock pouch and you were popping a label on it, and then you moved into a printed project?
Yeah, exactly. So for the first few months when I was still doing this part-time, I was exactly what you said, buying a stock pouch, labels. And then pretty quickly I graduated to the printed bags, because you know what, it was a lot to keep up with having a couple different SKUs, and printing out those labels and sticking them on myself added on a lot of labor time. And I was actually really surprised with the cost of flexible digitally printed pouches.
Yeah.
Was on par with the stickers, if not less potentially.
Yeah.
It's mainly the design cost, but that's up to you. Like it can be as complex or as simple as you want.
You're 100% right. You know what, the approach that you took of starting with a stock bag is really common and applying a label, but when you do cost it out, and I have these conversations every day, believe it or not, but yeah, when you cost it out and you do, whether it's a minimum order or, you know, you're starting to sort of scale it up and you can leverage economies of scale, as you suggested before, that really drops that unit price down and it becomes a lot more affordable. And from, even if you were to spend a couple more cents, or, you know, 10 or 15% more on a custom printed pouch, the value that it brings your brand in terms of brand equity and the way that your brand is perceived on the retail shelf, I think brings exponential value to you.
Yeah, definitely. I completely agree. I was surprised to get into a couple retailers. I was in 10 with the brown bags and the stickers, but they posed so many challenges that I didn't really expect. They got dirty very easily. They crinkled very easily. It just didn't look as great on the shelf, as you said. And the digitally printed pouches just make all of the difference.
That's awesome. Yep, such a smart decision to go in early. A couple of weeks ago, I interviewed Jordan from Sriracha Revolver Hot Sauce. And one of the things that she really focused on right from day one was the brand that she was establishing with, because she wanted to see the value, or she wanted the consumer to see the value in her brand. And also, you know, she really puts down the early success of that business down to the way the brand was built and the perception that it held, or the brand held, in the consumer's eye. Mm-hmm. And from what I can tell, you've done exactly the same thing. So was it a conscious decision right from the very start to establish a strong brand, or was it something that you were sort of developing on the fly?
A little bit of both, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I had a brand vision and had set out, you know, the brand identity with the designer that I work with.
Yeah.
Before launching.
Yeah.
So it had a look and feel, but it has also evolved over time. Like it is a little bit organic.
Yeah.
And as I've figured out what the brand is about, and, you know, pivoted to being a bit more of a snack and having this identity as this fun, exciting, kind of a surprise of a treat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's really helped me craft the brand identity and the look and feel and content creation around that.
Yeah, it's really cool. I find it to be, you know, leaning on the sort of the masculine side of branding, in terms of like, it's got such rich depth color to it, and it's really approachable. And yeah, I was really impressed, if that's worth anything, by the brand. I thought it was awesome. And
it definitely is. You've seen a lot of packaging.
I have seen a lot of packaging, and it was one that stood out to me. And the other thing that stood out to me is that did you launch with 4 SKUs right from the start, or did you launch with one and you have sort of grown over time?
No, I launched with 4.
Wow. Okay. Tell us a little about that. How did you go about formulating the flavors and landing on the 4 that you would eventually go with?
Yeah, looking back, it was pretty ambitious, and sometimes I kick myself a little bit for that. But one of the pillars of the brand is variety. Like I'm all about variety as a spice of life. I love changing things up and having different flavors, and I've always made so many different flavors of granola for myself. So I wanted to launch with a bit of variety. I wanted to have, you know, a really spicy pecan one, a very coconut summery flavor, and then a more of a cocoa flavor to appeal to people who like chocolate.
Yeah.
And then one that's just for everyday use. The nutty crumble is super versatile and works with anything.
Yeah.
So they were all derivatives of granola that I'd made before, but I did refine the recipe once I started to look at scaling it and look at, you know, I'd made granola forever, but when you actually have to weigh out the ingredients, it really changes it, and trying to nail down something that's consistent every single time was definitely tough.
Yeah, I can imagine. And you know, you're just about to approach your 12-month mark of business, and that's a huge achievement, so congratulations on that.
Thank you.
That's all right. And I guess you're going to be able to produce some data to sort of potentially help you build some new SKUs out in the future. But do you anticipate that granola is a seasonal item, or do you sort of see the sales to be relatively consistent over a 12-month period throughout the seasonality cycles?
Yeah, it's pretty consistent. Mm. I noticed a drop at the beginning of January, end of December, like right around that holiday season when people kind of shift their focus to pastries and desserts and things that aren't very good for you. And then early January, it shifts right back to healthy eating, because otherwise it's quite consistent year round. I have noticed some seasonality with my different flavors. So every quarter I've launched a seasonal flavor as well.
Yep.
And as a way to test out some new SKUs, and some have been super popular, and I think I'll bring on as standard flavors. And then some of my standard flavors, I've noticed a bit of seasonality with them, so I might switch them to seasonal flavors.
Yeah, yeah. I can imagine the retailers would really love having that variety as well on the shelf.
Yeah, it keeps things interesting and keeps consumers always looking for what's new when they come in.
That's awesome. You mentioned just prior to the show kicking off that you're currently sitting in an accelerator program, so I'd love to hear a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'm actually sitting in 2 of them,
right?
Which is really fun and exciting. One launched a month ago, and it's District Ventures.
District Accelerator. Ventures. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's under Arlene Dickinson.
Okay.
So it's a program that's one arm of her District Ventures umbrella that has District Ventures Capital, their marketing arm, and then this accelerator program.
Awesome.
And it isn't food specific.
Yep.
There are a lot of food brands that come out of the accelerator program. And then the other one is actually within the GTA region. It's with York University.
York.
And it's called Y Space.
Okay. And I'm just writing this down at the same time. Yeah, so I can look into it. Yeah, sorry.
Of course.
Cool.
It's the first food-specific accelerator of its kind in the GTA, which is it's really cool. It's very, very focused on launching a food brand. And, you know, there isn't a ton of information or a ton of support out there for this type of venture. And so many people pivot to launching food brands from other backgrounds and just have no experience in CPG.
Yeah, it's a whole other world, isn't it?
It's a whole other world. And, you know, it's something where you really want to hit the ground and make a positive impact and do it right off of the bat.
Yeah.
Of course, there's going to be some learning as you go, but the reputational aspect of trying to minimize mistakes right from the beginning I think is super important, and programs like this really help.
Yeah, without a doubt. And not only that, but also the network of peers that you can sort of insert yourself into as well. Have you found that to be the case?
Definitely. They're both very early on, but it's been so great to meet other founders and hear how passionate they are and why they started their brands and like things that they've faced already. And learn from them. It's been wonderful.
Do you have anybody that you look up to or anybody that you sort of, you know, bounce ideas off and, you know, communicate with when it comes to business decisions that you have to make or sort of the vision that you've got and sort of had the path to that vision?
Yes, definitely. There's quite a few female food founders that I've connected with. I was lucky enough to connect with Eve Laird very early on.
Great.
Yeah, and she provided some wonderful advice, as well as a granola producer in the U.S. Named Claire. She started a granola brand called Tefola.
Tefola.
And she has a teff farm.
Yeah.
And honestly, if Tefola was in Canada, I don't know if I would have launched my granola brand. It's really, really good.
What is teff?
Teff is it's a nutty grain.
Yeah.
So it's a grain that has this very nutty taste to it, and it just has a great flavor in granola.
I've never heard of it.
Yeah.
Crazy.
It's available at some health food stores, but it's not very, very common.
Yeah, yeah. Cool. I'm going to look into that as well. Teff. Mm-hmm. Why has that never crossed my path? Well, there you go. Awesome. So yeah, networking is really important. When you've been collaborating or, you know, communicating with everybody in your network, has there been any specific questions that you've gone to them with that you've found have been really insightful?
Not quite yet. Mm-hmm. I think there's been, you know, just little things along the way, and especially like being a solopreneur and trying to make decisions and navigate situations on my own. Sometimes it's just really helpful to bounce different ideas off of somebody else or different problems that I might be having.
Yeah. Yeah.
So being able to say like, hey, you know, is this normal? Is it normal to, for example, as you scale a recipe, it needs to change over time, and it's not going to be the same way that you made it in your kitchen when you were starting out. And that was something that I really struggled with early on, is changing my recipe. And I just didn't know if that was normal. I didn't know if that was done or if it was really, really important to stay true to that original formulation.
And doing 100 small batches rather than like 3 larger batches kind of thing. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Like if I use a stand mixer, and it's crazy how that changes the texture of the product versus mixing it by hand.
Yeah. Yeah.
And things that, you know, kind of in the back of your head, like, oh, I'm sure this makes a difference, but you just don't realize until you start scaling how big of a difference those things make.
Yeah. Got you. What kind of shelf life are you getting on your product?
So I put it very, very conservatively at 3 months right now, but it's most likely 6 or 12 months. Something that I found when changing packaging is all of the benefits that the packaging could have for my shelf life.
Yeah, the barrier for sure. Yeah,
exactly. And not having that window, I think is very, very helpful. Not having the light exposure, I have a metalized interior in the bags.
Yeah, that definitely makes a huge improvement. You know, there's a couple of acronyms out there, whether it's MTR, like moisture transfer rate, or OTR, oxygen transfer rate, depending on the product and the bag type that you're looking at, we'll look at different barrier types. And it's really cool to see how you can get really quite product specific. So like liquids have a different barrier than like a dry good, and coffee has a different barrier because like you just suggested, UV light plays a, or UV plays a huge role in the degradation of the product as well. Yeah. So 3 months is pretty standard out there. Have you found that it's been like when you've been going to the retailers and they've been talking to you about expected shelf life, 3 months seems to be around the time that they're expecting as well?
They typically expect a longer shelf life.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Pantry staple.
Yeah.
And so that's why I am trying to get it up there. It requires some time, of course, and testing. But most retailers have been okay with accepting or placing smaller orders, smaller, more frequent orders, so that they turn it over quicker. It's something that I worry about more so, because my worst fear is, you know, them just not having time to sell product and getting fed up with the short best before dates. But yep, most have been so understanding and so accommodating to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. Prior to working here at Foodpak, I was working for a coffee roaster, and and they were selling into retail, and the retailers that they were selling into have a 12-month shelf life expectation. And as everybody knows, in the coffee world, freshness is critical, and like you want to get your coffee at least 2 weeks out from roast date, so it's had time to settle and the oils are nice and you know, settle within the bean, and you get that full aroma and flavor out of the coffee. But when you're opening a bag of coffee up at sort of the 12th, you know, 8 to 12 month mark, you do have a question mark over your head as to what's this going to be like. And you know, obviously you've got the valve on the bag and you've got the barrier protection in the bag, and if it's all stored correctly, there really shouldn't be much different to like the regular average coffee drinker shouldn't be able to tell the difference. But one thing that we did find is that lab testing is pretty critical to sort of see where, if there is any contamination in there, sort of what rate, you know, of degradation it can cause as well. So do you have a local lab that you're going to work with when you're doing all of these tests as well? And how far into the future, I guess you'll sort of like, you'll be placing products pretty soon and then you'll be testing monthly to sort of see if there's any bacterial growth over a 12-month period and sort of see where your sort of future lies. Is that the approach that you're going to take with them?
Yeah. So I'm pretty lucky in my ingredient formulation. I don't really have any high risk ingredients or ingredients that degrade quickly or go off quickly. I had one that I was considering using, but I eliminated it pretty early on for that reason. So just purely based off of my ingredient list and my baking method, I've been working with a food scientist and she did say, you know, this is 6 to 12 months, no
perfect
problem.
Yeah.
So I'm doing testing directly right now, but I do also have earmarked to work with George Brown College, which does some food testing in the city.
Yeah. Very good.
Yeah, which is a great resource.
Yeah, it'll be nice to sort of have that locked down when you get to that point as well.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back to the consumer. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about how you've been able to procure information from the consumer, if any. Like, have you been putting out surveys? Have you been building mailing lists? Like, what's your approach there?
Yeah, that's actually something that I've found very difficult with with COVID.
Yeah.
I was very excited to launch in farmers markets.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was hoping to launch last summer in farmers markets, but with the pandemic, most of them change their requirements. So typically to have a product in a farmer's market, you don't need to be in a commercial kitchen.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So I was planning on testing out there, but with the updated requirement, I just didn't have a commercial kitchen in time to make the season.
Yeah.
I'm in a few this upcoming season, but it's a bit of a different beast than it normally is. You know, the interaction's quite minimized.
And are you able to sample?
No, not able to sample. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's probably the biggest thing that you can get out of a farmer's market is getting that instantaneous reaction to a sample.
Exactly. And getting that feedback, even if you're a regular at a farmer's market, getting that feedback from regulars who come week after week and maybe have had a chance to try it and come back and talk to you, because, you know, consumers right now are just bombarded with surveys from from websites that they purchase from. You always get that, hey, leave a review. And some are so, so kind and generous to do that. And I'm so thankful to the people that do.
Yeah, I'm always amazed as well.
But not everyone has time. you know, it takes time, it takes effort. And when we're spending so much time on our computers these days, I really don't blame them. So it is hard to get that data and to get that reaction. Something that I do that I mentioned before is a little bit of virtual sampling. Mm-hmm. So I launched online these snack packs, mm-hmm. that are single serving bags of each of my flavors, and I offer free shipping on those. So it's a little bit of a lower barrier way for people to try it. It's $10 flat, free shipping, and they're able to try all the different flavors. And I've partnered with a few of my retailers to do sampling that way. It always has to be in a sealed bag. There's just no open sampling anymore.
Yeah, there's no way around it. Yeah.
Yeah. But sometimes you get feedback from that, which is great. And you know, you got to work with what you have.
Yeah. You've heard of Hippie Snacks, the CPG mm-hmm. brand over here from Left Coast Naturals. Yeah. So Lauren, I'm going to say she's the marketing manager or director of marketing, but she's definitely way up there in terms of marketing for the organization. And she put together some sampling videos where she was actually like in front of the video, describing the product, tasting it, describing the texture and the flavor profile. And that was some really cool videos. She put them up on LinkedIn and I really enjoyed watching those. And I thought it was a really smart approach to be able to not only sell a product to whether it's a, you know, a distributor or a retailer, but the consumer can also get in front of that as well. And I think it makes for some really cool content.
Oh, so shout out to, idea. Yeah, I shout out to Lauren. Need to check that out.
Yeah, you should. yeah, definitely up on LinkedIn. Yeah, check it out. Lauren Archibald. I'll just send you her name after the podcast.
Yes, please.
Yeah, no worries. So it sounds to me as if, like every entrepreneur out there in the early stages, you're doing absolutely everything right now. How many hours a week are you spending on the business? Like I can imagine it would be almost every waking hour.
Oof. Yeah, it is almost every waking hour.
Yeah.
I'd say my days lately are typically between 10 and 12 hours.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's usually 6 days a week. Mm-hmm. Not that long hours every single day. Sometimes it varies, of course, but you know, sometimes you're out doing deliveries and sometimes it's just all day answering emails and on calls and that sort of thing. So it's a lot of different types of work, which it doesn't feel quite as draining coming from an office job where it's computer all day, every day.
Yeah. Yeah.
Having that variety in there is really nice.
I was going to say, would you want to be doing anything else?
No.
No.
I can't answer. Imagine doing anything else anymore.
And that's awesome. Good for you. Yeah. And where do you find that you're spending the vast majority of your time? Is there any sort of component of the business that you're particularly focused on right now?
Right now I'm doing a lot of strategic planning.
Yeah.
Cool. So having launched officially and full-time in January 2021, I launched this new packaging the end of the month in January. You know, I've got a lot of feedback from the first few months out there and had some great growth with the different stores that I'm in that time. And I think what I'm focused on now is just planning out what the next year looks like, what the next 2 years look like, and really honing down on that brand messaging and how I hope to put this company out there.
Yeah, good for you. How have you found that process? Are you like when you are doing some strategic planning, are you using any specific software or are you just like taking notes or journaling or how do you go about recording all of that?
I just do it in Word documents.
Yeah.
But it is kind of funny, like building a brand is such an interesting thing because you're just pulling it out of nowhere.
Yeah.
You know, like you have all of these ideas, but actually putting them down on paper and making them clear and concise is really hard. And it's given me so much more respect for the brands that are out there that like, you know what they're about instantly. You read their description, you see their packaging and you get it. And that's a very, very hard thing to do. And it takes a lot of time and a lot of thought. So I mostly brainstorm and then there's different iterations. So, you know, it's a living document that evolves over time.
It has to be, doesn't it? Yeah, for mm-hmm. sure. Yeah. There are some genius brands and people that are marketing their businesses out there. And you're absolutely right. There are some cool case studies out there that I've come across on brand and the way that they've approached it. And there are some that I'll give you the name of after the podcast as well that have built in a really cool persona and voice into their brand as well. And it's so recognizable. Actually, I'll talk about one now. There's one called Frank Body in Australia, which is a coffee scrub. I don't know if you've come across Frank. And the persona and the voice of that brand is so recognizable that any literature that you read, you know straight off the bat that it's a Frankie sort of branded piece. And they were extremely successful really, really quickly. It started off just as a coffee scrub. They were just grinding up coffee and putting it in a bag with essential oils. And you know, then people would jump in the shower with it and scrub and exfoliate their body with it. And it was really cool. I started a business before I came to Canada called Black Honey Coffee Scrub. And I put mine in a tube and I sort of went through the same process that you're doing with More Granola when I was doing my Masters of Entrepreneurship and Innovation in terms of writing the business plan and, you know, doing all of my market research and product validation and testing and getting customer feedback and validation, all that kind of stuff. And I hit the market with my product in a tube, which is a point of variation with a competitor who was Frank. But they had such a strong brand out there. I mean, there were multiple reasons why Black Honey didn't work out. And one of them was that I moved to Canada and I just couldn't bring the business with me. And my business partner at the time, he was busy as well. So we decided to shut up shop there. But it's always in the back of my mind that if I had have stayed, where would that have gone? And I believe that we could have seen some success, but the competition was really strong out there. And it's good to have strong competitors out there because you can sort of really bolster your own strategic sort of vision for the business and the way that you're going to differentiate yourself. But who are you looking to in terms of competitors, and how are you sort of keeping an eye on what the competitive landscape is out there as well?
Yeah, gosh, first of all, Black Honey sounds amazing.
Yeah, it was
good. I don't know if there's an equivalent here. Like, is there a coffee scrub?
There are, but they don't seem to be like in a liquid form. So mine, it was actually pretty unique in that I worked in a coffee roastery as well. And I was a barista on a bar and we just had a ridiculous amount, like every cafe, of coffee grinds that get thrown into the regular waste stream. Mm-hmm. And coffee grinds are really high in oils, coffee oil. And they're really great exfoliant ingredients as well. So what I was doing is I was collecting these used coffee grinds and taking them out of the waste stream. And I was drying them in like a commercial warming rack that, you know, catering companies use to keep food warm. And then I was collecting up a large enough batch to then get them irradiated so that there wasn't any microbiological contamination. And then I was giving that ingredient to a co-packer who then produced the coffee scrub and packed it into the tubes that I provided them with. So it was okay. Co-packing agreement. And then I took receipt of the stock and I was marketing and selling it. And, great in theory, but there was a lot of work and labor that went into the collecting of the coffee grinds and the processing of the coffee grinds and then getting it into their hands as well. So the margin that I would have hoped to have been built into the product just got eroded really quickly. So it was a business model that wasn't necessarily strong. And as well, I mean, there were multiple problems that would have needed, you know, further work to sort of solve to make the business or to put the business in a position where it would have become profitable quickly. And then the other issue that we had as well was that, I mean, the shelf life was great because the coffee was being irradiated, so there wasn't any sort of contamination there, but shipping, it was really expensive to ship it or get it into the consumer's hands when they were buying one tube at a time through the mail. It was probably, you know, upwards of $15 per unit just to ship it. So yeah. I was splitting the cost with the consumer and absorbing a lot of it in my margin, and the margins were just so thin in the end that it just didn't make sense. But it was a fun experience, and even like having that business fail and the amount that I learned in the starting up, the short operation, and then the closing down of the business was probably more valuable than my master's in its entirety. So I'm glad I went through that process, but I mean, financially took a hit but that's just life. You just move on and keep looking forward, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I can believe that. Funnily enough, when I had originally planned on launching, I used to make my granola with egg whites.
Yeah. Cool.
But to make it clumpy, but I wanted this to be a vegan product.
Yeah.
So I was looking for substitutions. And one of the substitutions for egg whites is this liquid called aquafaba, if you've heard of it.
No.
It's the liquid that comes in a chickpea can. So
So
it's quite
starchy, kind of.
Quite starchy, exactly. And so I was planning out, okay, if I'm going to launch this granola brand using aquafaba, maybe I can partner with a hummus company and get their aquafaba, but it sounds like similar to collecting the coffee grinds. Yeah. It just would have been an operational nightmare. And I'm so glad I didn't end up going in that direction. But
yeah, great in theory. Hey, yeah.
Great in theory, not so great when you actually try and think about scaling it, which is important. But to answer your questions about competitors, there's so many in the category. And because I'm kind of sitting at the intersection of two categories, so granola cereal and granola bars, it's really endless. And there's new innovations coming out all of the time. So honestly, I think it's a little bit helpful for me to put on blinders. Like, of course, you need to know the stats, you need to know what different categories there are within the category. You need to know what their differentiators are, what their price points are, and all of that. But otherwise, I think to keep your messaging, especially when you're doing it yourself, to keep your messaging really clear and unique, it needs, your voice needs to be uncomplicated and kind of distracted by what's going on around you, because it's just relentless if you,
Yeah, especially on social media as well.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So if you're constantly like looking left and right, I think sometimes you don't know which way is forward for your own brand.
Yeah.
So as much as possible, I try to keep those blinders on.
No, that makes sense. On the episode that just went live prior to yours going out, I interviewed Aaron Chin, the CEO of Organica, which is a healthcare company based over here in BC. And they've been in business for over 30 years. And innovation is just ingrained in their culture within the organization. And when I'm talking about innovation, like, they're extremely innovative and they're coming out with products that you just are new. And Aaron was suggesting that at times in the past, they've launched a product that was just before its time and it flopped because the consumer just wasn't ready for it. And I can imagine in the granola world, innovation would be really kind of hard, but you've sort of come up with a product that's sort of, like you suggested, is fitting two categories. What's your sort of approach to coming up with new ideas, if you have any? And what's your approach to sort of scaling and growing the business in terms of like further SKUs into the future?
So I have so many different granola SKUs in the pipeline with the dessert inspired flavors. It's just endless. Like, the possibilities are really exciting, and I think I could do quite a few different SKUs.
Cool.
A few that are already planned and a few that I still want to test out. And then in terms of different product lines, I have a couple ideas as well. Right now I'm debating, you know, you don't want your different product lines to be too unrelated, you know, so trying to find that bridge between different ideas that you have. And so your core mission is still consistent across all your different product lines, I think is very important.
Yeah. Good advice.
Yeah. But I've always loved cooking and love food. So the inspiration's there and the excitement for different ideas is there for sure.
Fantastic. We just, prior to speaking about the consumer and the competitive landscape, we just sort of touched on the amount of time and energy and hours that you're putting into the business at the moment. When you're not working on more granola, what do you do with yourself? Like, do you have any side, any hobbies or anything else that you sort of, can sink your teeth into to take your mind off the business?
Yeah. I love cooking, and that still does take my mind off of the business as long as I'm not making granola. And then anything active, really. Like, it's been so important to find time to get outside every day, and it's really easy right now not to get outside, especially working from home and, you know, not necessarily going out for any specific reason. So trying to stay active, and I've gotten really into cycling lately, which has been a lot of fun.
Yeah. When you get a good sweat on like that, do you find that you're able to sort of like think through ideas and sort of make decisions, and it sort of helps with your mental clarity as well?
Completely. Yeah. Sometimes when you feel really stuck or uninspired, you just need to either get outside or move. And I find it's a little bit frustrating because so many ideas and so many breakthroughs come to me when I'm getting a sweat on, as you said.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'm like, should I have a notepad with me when I'm working out, or should I, like, do I just leave it? And, you know, you end up coming back to the paper and feeling so inspired and solving so many problems. So many people think it's you know, I can't take that hour out of my day, but I find it really helps with my efficiency.
Yeah, I've heard that from so many people. You know what I do when I'm out having a sweat and I need to take a note is I just use the voice recorder on my phone, because I've always got my phone with me because I'm listening to a podcast or music or something when I'm working out. And yeah, just quick little voice memo, and that works for me.
Oh, it's a really good idea. I'll have to try that out.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Awesome. Hey, listen, we've covered so much ground, and honestly, I feel as if I've learned a lot from you, and I always do feel as if I learn a lot. And I know the feedback from all of the listeners out there is that they love listening to stories just like yours. So thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Awesome. But before we do leave, you know, I just want to ask one more question. So, you know, you're so new into this whole business, and I'm sure you're going to have a successful and long career at More Granola. However, if you were to sort of go back and make any changes to the business, early changes that you would have, that you made, or decisions that you made on the business, what would they be?
You know what? It's kind of hard because I've learned so much the way that it has played out. Like, part of me wishes I could go back and plan out this perfect launch, you know, have a completed product, completed idea, complete website, brand mission and everything right from day one. As you see so many brands do, they just launch with this market ready packaging and everything. But honestly, the way that it worked out for me, like, I learned so much and it gave me the flexibility to pivot. Launching in this soft way, and that was really valuable and really helped me create something quite unique. So and it helped me validate that there was traction for it. You know, because that being in such a crowded category, it's, is there even room, is there even demand for this other granola brand when there's already so many? So validating that was really important for me to decide that I wanted to do this full time and pursue it.
Yeah. So you just sort of had to make decision to just go, damn it, I'm going to do this, rather than sort of just like getting fixated on making sure that everything's perfect first. Was that the case?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm quite a perfectionist normally. So I think that's held me back in the past. And there was something about the way that it was like a perfect storm of coming back from the MBA when you're feeling inspired and you're on a roll and, you know, you kind of have this impetus to do something and to fill your time. And so it just, I didn't think too much about it. And I just launched it, and it was the best decision, I think, because of how much I was able to learn by just going before it was perfect, before it was ready, before it was 100% done, and just starting. And you can always iterate. You can always pivot. You can always make changes along the road. And I still did have a more official launch. So, it's, there's no one way to start a company, right?
Yeah, no, totally. I think that's great advice. So on that note, thank you very much, Sarah. I really appreciate the time, and we'll keep in touch. I'd love to interview you again in 12 months' time and hear how the second year went for you.
Yeah, that would be great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening today. If you have any questions from today's episode or would like to know more about what I can do to help you achieve your packaging vision, you can reach me directly at hayden@thepackheavypodcast.com. You could DM me on Instagram @thepackheavypodcast, or we could also connect on LinkedIn and start a conversation there. I'll see you next week.